From the ACLU, this is At Liberty. I'm Kendall Seismeyer, your host. Today, we're zooming in on Chicago, the country's third largest and one of the most diverse cities, and a city that has been a blueprint for housing segregation, still deeply felt all across aspects of city life today. While the discriminatory practice of racial redlining was officially outlawed in 1968, still today, for every $1 banks loan in Chicago's white neighborhoods, they invest just 12 cents in the city's black neighborhoods, and 13 cents in Latino areas, according to a 2020 study by WBEZ and City Bureau. A typical household's wealth in the richest area of Chicago is 206 times higher than a typical household's wealth in the poorest area. This continued housing inequity lies at the crux of the city's ongoing struggles against gun and gang violence, unemployment, and homelessness, but are often overlooked. The system was designed to create these problems, so we shouldn't be surprised or scoff in reaction. It's time to learn how so many Chicagoans were set up to struggle, and how we can all be a part of undoing the legacy of racism that pervades the city's map. Here to talk with us about Chicago's infamous housing history, ongoing consequences, and nationwide influence is Mike Amezcua, Associate History Professor at Georgetown University and author of Making Mexican Chicago, From Post-War Settlement to the Age of Gentrification. Mike, welcome to At Liberty.
Hi, Kendall. Thanks for having me today.
So, Making Mexican Chicago is such an important book, and it really captures the multi-ethnic character of Chicago that has fought to survive since the post-war era. Although now 65% of Chicago's residents identify as Black, Latino, or Asian, it remains one of the most segregated in America. Because we don't often discuss housing on this podcast, could you give our listeners just a high-level, quick primer on how segregation itself is an important social determinant for broader life outcomes?
Absolutely. Almost all of our life opportunities have so much to do with where we grew up, what our zip code is, what opportunities we have as young people in America. And Chicago is a very important city when it comes to the kind of early crafting of housing inequality, housing policies that emerged in the 1930s and that continue to impact where people live, why Chicago is so segregated, and what kinds of investments or patterns of disinvestment exist in the city today. You know, we recently had a kind of big conversation on Twitter over some of the youth crime that has been talked about in the media in Chicago. But that conversation ought to be a historical conversation, not about always about the crime that youth are partaking in, but rather the lack of opportunities that youth have had in the city of Chicago, the long legacies of disinvestment for jobs, housing inequality, recreation inequality.
Mm. In your book, you spotlight that two of the major tools of modern segregation find their roots in Chicago: redlining and racial covenants. They're central practices in the history of housing in America. First, can you detail what redlining and racial covenants are for people who might not know? And then can you walk us through some of their development in Chicago?
Redlining was a form of color coding and detailing to potential lenders where there might be risk in lending for housing, for mortgage assignments. There was all sorts of color coding that surveyors created as part of a kind of national project by the federal government to create a kind of mapping system that could tell the government where they can finance or where they can back mortgage lending. And so the red shading or the red lining became the most kind of deleterious communicator of warning risk. You know, this was the red flag for lending. And typically a surveyor was assigned particular neighborhoods across urban America and where there was either a kind of dimension of multiracial residents or multi-ethnic dimension that typically would have told that surveyor to mark it as shaded in red. That was the highest liability in terms of lending. The restrictive covenant comes a little earlier in the 1920s, born in Chicago, really mobilized by the Chicago Real Estate Board to put it into the contract as to prohibiting the purchasing of homes by Black families in particular neighborhoods. And so this would have disallowed a white homeowner to sell to a Black home buyer. And it was written into the contract itself. The restrictive covenant gets outlawed in the late 1940s in Chicago and then later across America, but it lasted for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, even a local news station said that modern segregation was as much a product of Chicago as deep dish pizza, which I think is notable.
Definitely.
Redlining especially has received attention in the last few years as disparities in healthcare, education, and income to this day map directly onto the homeowners loan corporation maps of the 1940s, 1950s in many cities, including Chicago. When Mexicans first emigrated to Chicago, where were the areas redlining and racism confined them to, and what were these areas like?
I love that question. That's such a smart question because it really gets to those initial settlement points for the Mexican community and their initial link to areas that are already considered to be problematic in terms of lending. So the first waves of Mexican migrants arrive in the late 19-teens. They are initially recruited by some of the most prominent industries in Chicago at the time, steel, meatpacking, and railroad work. And so if you can imagine these three industries, these are industries that are kind of hugging Lake Michigan. They are on the south side. They are in northwest Indiana. So they are industries that are kind of along the lake and in areas that are very industrial. Mexicans took residence literally in between the kind of growing racial segregation of African Americans and white Chicagoans. So they kind of take that in-between space, that liminal space. And these areas are already considered not the most beautiful. These are not middle-class homes. In fact, some of the first places that Mexican immigrants live in are boxcars, actual railroad cars that have been converted temporarily into housing quarters for Mexican laborers. That's the kind of initial settlement in the 19-teens and 1920s.
Mm. I want to talk about two different stories from the book. You talk about, like, in addition to redlining and covenants, cycles of underinvestment, poverty, urban renewal, gentrification, and displacement caused the Mexican community to be jostled through neighborhoods and to find new ones over time. There are two neighborhoods I want to talk about in particular, Little Village and Pilsen. The stories you tell of both of these neighborhoods are incredible because they show how insidious the discrimination was, but also how innovative the community became in response. Little Village came together in part due to displacement caused by the University of Illinois Chicago. I was wondering if you could take us back to the impetus to create that new neighborhood.
Definitely, yes. When you think of Chicago's Mexican communities, you have to talk about Pilsen and Little Village. These are the the kind of crown jewel neighborhoods of the Mexican diaspora in the Midwest. Little Village is the result, really, of, like, as you said, the displacement out of the kind of near West Side community, which is just west of the loop of downtown Chicago. This becomes a highly coveted area by the city, by downtown business elites that seek to remake it as part of this bigger super loop that would bring in a more kind of white collar workforce, perhaps more tax yielding people and property. This is the home of the University of Illinois at Chicago. And of course, the flip side is that it displaces so many people, of course, not just Mexicans, but Puerto Ricans, African Americans, and ethnic whites as well. But it creates an opportunity for the real estate industry that's paying attention as to how to perhaps use the displacement of Mexicans as an opportunity to sell homes or rent homes to this displaced diaspora. It doesn't mean that the entire real estate industry is open to this, but a few kind of enterprising real estate agents are looking at this as an opportunity. One of them is Anita Villarreal, one of the first Latina real estate agents in Chicago, who was displaced herself out of the Near West Side, and who, newly armed with a real estate license, begins to try to buy and sell property in Pilsen and in Little Village. Now, it wasn't easy. The real estate industry in these neighborhoods is trying to stop her. She wasn't the only one. There were other kind of ethnic white leaders in the community that also saw an opportunity in opening up South Lawndale to Mexican immigrants. One of them was Richard Dolidge, who also decided that he would, as a real estate agent, open up certain parts of the neighborhood to Mexican immigrants that were, for the most part, cash-carrying Mexican laborers looking to rent or to buy a home. One of the things that Richard Dolidge is known for is actually changing the branding of South Lawndale. He changes the name of the neighborhood in response to the increasing Black settlement of Black residents in the west side of Chicago in North Lawndale, which previously was a Jewish neighborhood. He tries to disentangle or disassociate South Lawndale from North Lawndale and give it a kind of new name, calls it Little Village, to kind of reflect back to the early Eastern and Central European villages in the Czech Republic, in Poland, but even when he's doing that, the old ethnic white communities, they are leaving Little Village in droves, and so Anita Villarreal enters the neighborhood, rebrands it herself into La Villita, and begins to develop a kind of sales pitch for that displaced Mexican diaspora to say, hey, this may not look like a Mexican community, but it will be a Mexican community. I can sell you this bungalow home here. I can rent you an apartment over here. There will be supermarkets here, taquerias, panaderias. And so she really kind of banks on a future of a Mexican neighborhood early on and really turns it into a profitable business for herself.
So Anita Villarreal is such an interesting character, and she's very prominent in the book. When we think about white flight as a phenomenon, we think about divestment. But I really appreciate that she actually saw an opportunity for revitalization. And you say Anita shrewdly sold what we might call a white flight script to these anxious white homeowners. And Little Village was kind of seen as this racial barrier between the white neighborhoods and the Black neighborhoods, which is very interesting to me. How do you see this dynamic play out in the relationship between the Mexican and Black communities today?
Yeah. So, you know, what Anita was doing in the 1960s, which was opening up restricted neighborhoods, right? These were kind of staunchly white neighborhoods that were, not only were they leery of the presence of Mexican immigrants in their communities, but of course they were deeply mobilized against African Americans moving into their neighborhoods. And sometimes we forget that Chicago's Southwest Side and Little Village included was the site of a kind of counter civil rights movement, meaning that these were very organized ethnic white leaders that were challenging the state and the city to stop measures for open housing or fair housing ordinances. So we need that history to understand the kind of the culture within these communities, right? So when Anita is coming in, she's trying to open up these neighborhoods, but she's also kind of dealing with a deeply entrenched anti-blackness and perhaps even participating in that anti-blackness because she's trying to buy homes from anxious white families and then turning around and selling them to Mexican immigrants. And she was sued all the time for that by white community organizations. And she was protested and she was called a blockbuster. I think, of course, Chicago remains deeply segregated. And there is a kind of discourse around the differences between kind of Latino segregation and Black segregation. In Latino communities, they're mostly places that have tons of restaurants, tons of supermarkets. That's not the case in many Southside Black Chicago areas. The lack of, affordable foods in Black communities in Chicago is a telling sign that there is a longer, deeper, deeply entrenched practice of money segregation in these communities. You know, if it doesn't make financial sense for many of these corporations to place a supermarket in a Black community, they won't do it, right? So, I think that kind of takeaway transcends over to the real estate market too. Now Black Chicago spaces are always ripe for gentrification as well, right? I mean, Bronzeville is a place with a lot of new swanky condos, but it maintains a kind of Black creative base, which I think makes it interesting and worthy of more study, so we can understand who is being displaced in these these places. But I think that there is something that we ought to understand fundamentally a lot more about how gentrification and value and the difference between Black spaces and Latino spaces enters into the real estate market and into the buying and selling of neighborhoods.
Thank you so much for that, Mike. The second neighborhood story that I want to highlight is that of Pilsen. You depict how Pilsen has fought off gentrification since its development into the city's largest Mexican neighborhood, beginning in the 1960s. Can you tell us about Pilsen and its history?
Let me just say a few things about Pilsen. Pilsen, which was an older community, and actually the community that receives the most displaced Mexican residents, more so than Little Village, has a kind of becomes more of a site of contestation. And what I mean by that is that residents there become weary of the federal government and the city entering into any aspect that tries to dictate what buildings they're going to knock down, what community they're going to bulldoze. And so the Pilsen Mexican American community develop a much more, I would say, resistant attitude toward city intervention into their lives. And so this is a site that becomes a kind of mecca for community control, a mecca for the Chicano movement in the 1960s and 70s, and a community that really begins to dictate the terms of their own community to City Hall. They develop a really oppositional kind of consciousness against Mayor Daley, in contrast to Little Village, that begins to become the place Mayor Daley likes to visit. to promote his platform to Mexican Americans. Pilsen is enemy territory for Mayor Daley in the 1960s and 70s.
Yeah, I mean, Pilsen is such an interesting neighborhood. What is so striking about Pilsen is this power of resistance. Political resistance is it's a hotbed, as you mentioned, and that what's the legacy of community organizing in Pilsen?
It is a very complex legacy, but also a very rich one. Very early on in the 1950s, there is an organization that gets created called the Pilsen Neighbors Community Council. This is created by what I would call liberal whites that live in the neighborhood and are trying to offer an alternative to urban renewal, which they see as very dangerous for their community. But over time, as the neighborhood itself is changing demographically, the Mexican American and Mexican immigrant residents of the community do not feel represented by Pilsen Neighbors Community Council. And so by the mid to late 1960s, they take over the organization and they reclaim it as a Mexican-centric organization. They keep the name Pilsen Neighbors Community Council, but they adorn their letterheads with the symbols of the Chicano movement, Mesoamerican symbols, and a kind of platform that whatever they choose to do for their community will always keep in mind the kind of working class Mexican immigrant dynamics of the community itself, right? So it becomes a very militant organization that is rooted in community control, meaning that they're influenced by national community control movements happening in New York, happening in Texas, in which local resident groups are saying, we want a better school in our community. We want better parks. We want more resources coming from the city that draws from our taxes, right? And in that sense, Pilsen has a very strong identity of itself as a Mexican community that is, that has a kind of community control philosophy. And so when we're talking about, displacement by kind of wealthy developers or gentrification in the 1970s or 80s, it really runs up against this community that already has a long history of not only researching who's doing what, but also developing a counter response. This community stops Mayor Daley from creating what was called Chicago 21, which was a kind of master plan in 1973 to remake Pilsen into kind of an extension of downtown, to build a lot of condos, to make the kind of south branch of the Chicago River this kind of riverway for condo dwellers to get to work in downtown. So Pilsen stops at, yeah.
It's currently gentrifying, and its history is at risk for sure.
Absolutely.
Between 2011 and 2020, Chicago's 60608 zip code witnessed its median household income rise over 43%, which is the largest increase in the entire city. And it also coincided with a 17% decrease in its Latino population and a 28% increase in its white population.
Yes.
So we're seeing this happen right now. What do efforts look like to resist this?
You know, the efforts are kind of multiple, and they are not all of the same kind of mindset. There are long time, you asked me about the legacy of community development and community control. There are long time organizations in the community, such as Pilsen Neighbors, such as the Resurrection Project, which is a faith-based housing developing a nonprofit. These are kind of longtime organizations that have had their own kind of answers to stabilizing the presence of working class people in Pilsen. But there are newer organizations and perhaps even more kind of progressive / militant organizations that have said these organizations aren't doing enough. The older kind of legacy organizations haven't actually defeated or stopped gentrification. And so there's a lot of kind of younger progressive organizations that are literally trying to shame. They're using kind of shame methods or campaigns to shame housing developers or business owners that that are displacing older working class Latino owned businesses. So I think that from my perspective as a historian, when I say that in the past there's been an attempt to stop gentrification in the 70s and in the 80s, really what I'm seeing is that it was obviously a victory then, but really it only kind of hit pause on it for a little while. And as you point out, what's happened now in the past 20 years is really an inequitable form of displacement. I mean, you mentioned the percentages of the Latino population, which is decreasing in Pilsen and in that zip code. So I think that it's looking like a losing battle right now. If really what we're looking for is a community that creates stable housing conditions for working class residents.
Thank you so much for that. I think that's really important to talk about how this is happening right now. Are there ways that you think that we can invest in neighborhoods like Pilsen without displacing the community?
That's a really good question, and one that I get a lot. I think that ultimately what we're talking about here is capitalism and money and value. And sometimes in this country, the social determinants of who has more value than others has a lot to do with who they are, meaning their race, ethnicity, how they speak, how they look, right? So I think that right now where the money is flowing in terms of investment in Pilsen is mostly to venture capitalists or restaurant corporations that are looking to bring business and housing development into Pilsen. If you are a working class family in Pilsen today and you go to, I mean, name your bank and you're looking for a loan in Pilsen, chances are you're not going to get that loan. And so I think for that reason, it's really an uphill battle in terms of finding opportunities to create, a housing or livable infrastructure in a community that's so hot in terms of real estate in Pilsen. So I think it means that any kind of investment that's happening in a community like Pilsen right now, it is contributing in some form or fashion to working class, middle class displacement.
Thank you so much for that. You know, coming out of the conversation we're having about Pilsen and how to invest in community without displacing it, given all that we've spoken about and all of the loud and then more quiet and insidious ways people of color have been implicated in this system to really lessen their power and opportunity in the city of Chicago through defining where and why and how they settle, how do you tie this all together to help people better understand Chicago as the city as it is today, especially in the context of a lot of the outsider naysaying and critics about, you know, the presence of violence in the city today?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what I would say to anybody looking to understand Chicago today, we can't look at these things in a vacuum. They are connected to these longer patterns of segregation, of housing inequality, the environmental racism that we read about in the newspaper is often cited and placed in Black and brown communities in Chicago, right? Communities where these industries feel like there's less of a voice, there's less of a kind of a political clout in these areas, right? And I think that simply that's just not true. I mean, these communities are very vocal and very well organized, and often have their own kind of counter response or reports to the kind of environmental degradation and toxins that are released in their communities. But part of their critique on the part of these grassroots organizations is that it comes from a long history of disinvestment in their neighborhoods. And so I think for any person that wants to understand Chicago today, and I think it serves again as a great example for understanding urban America, is that it has to do with again, earlier practices of discrimination in housing and opportunities. Let's take, for instance, Pilsen. It has a high school, Benito Juarez, that is an example of that community control fight in the 1970s. The community, parents, mothers fought for that high school when that community didn't have a high school there. Now, whose high school is it going to be? I mean, the high school was intended for the children of Mexican immigrants, of working class parents and families. And this community asset is now at the crossroads of a major socioeconomic change in Pilsen, right? So what will happen to these community assets that Black and Brown Chicagoans have fought for the last 50 years as they enter the hands of wealthier folks that are moving in? And I think that that's also part of the conversation that we ought to have, not just in Chicago, but everywhere, you know, Philadelphia, New York City, Los Angeles, places that have had a long history of disinvestment and then a kind of swooping in gentrification that really puts these assets, whether we're talking about a community park or a school or public housing or affordable housing, at risk, right? And I think it's part of the conversation today in Chicago.
Awesome. Well, we really appreciate that you are starting that conversation and really diving deep into this history. And also really, I think oftentimes we talk in white and black terms when we talk about housing discrimination. And I think it's really important that you're focusing on the Mexican community in the city. I know that one of my friends who I work with at the ACLU is a Mexican from Chicago, and she grew up in these neighborhoods, and it meant a lot for her to see your work. So really appreciate all that you're doing, and thank you for helping us break some of this down. So thanks. Thanks so much, Mike.
Thank you, Kendall, for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to At Liberty wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review the show. We really appreciate the feedback.